Welcome to the Men of 8 Gang Podcast, episode 356. I am Steve Borsch, and I'm on with Tim Elliott.
Good morning.
Phil Wilson.
Hello.
And our very special guest host, Julio Ojeda Zapata.
Hola.
Now, I just have to tell you that I wasn't sure how to alphabetize you three. So, Julio, are you an O or a Z?
Oh, I don't care. Whatever.
It's hyphenated, right? Isn't it?
It's
an O.
I guess it would be O, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, my bride's going to Puerto Rico on Monday.
Oh, neat.
She's
what
down
for?
There to do some workshops in the home for a home furnishing association.
Oh, I thought she was researching the biography for Julio.
Well, she is going to do some due diligence, some background, criminal background check when she's down there. So,
right.
Tell her to just enjoy the trip, but to be cautious. It's the crime rate in Puerto Rico is completely out of control, and it's a great place to get mugged.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, great.
Yeah,
Julio.
She's being squared around.
That's going to make Steve feel good now.
Well, also your AT&T doesn't, mobile network doesn't cover Puerto Rico, right? So it's out of network. It's considered
probably
roaming. Yeah, I think so. Anyway, let's jump into stories because we have a guest that's going to join us in about 15 minutes. So
yeah, we'll be chatting with Jason Barnett from Flarion. So stay by
yeah,
for that
yeah.
startup. Hey, so the health tech industry with another. We talked about proliferation of tech jobs and not enough people to fill them, and that pretty much stands true for the health tech industry too, it looks like.
Well, no kidding.
Yeah.
So this was a really good article, but I also was stunned by a conversation with someone who shall remain nameless. That's an executive at Allina who was talking about the physician and nurse shortage on top of this, because I was asking about this. Are they having challenges? And the answer is yes, because everybody wants the same people, but also at the same time, the physician and nurse shortage is accelerating. So it's going to be a tough time for the old med tech industry, I think.
Well, but yeah, good for those people that want to work in the med tech industry, right?
True.
So it's kind of like those that want to demand high dollars. And that's always good news.
Yeah.
Better to have more jobs than less.
Yep. Well, and then there was this article in Fast Company about Mayo Clinic has created a technology said to alleviate nausea from VR, virtual reality.
Some algorithm they've developed, and they're hoping to license it to folks like Oculus and other VR manufacturers.
Well, and you know what? I mean, people talk about this is like, come on, seriously? Nausea and VR, but I was just listening to a conversation on one of the twit.tv podcasts, and people, and Leo Laporte was talking about feeling nausea, and so were some other people. So it is, I guess it's a big deal. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, it's something that I've experienced somewhat severely myself. I get seasick easily, and I can't wear VR helmets for more than 5 or 10 minutes before I start feeling queasy, and it's one of the problems that's going to keep this particular technology from moving forward into mass adoption unless it's addressed, because there's going to be a fairly significant percentage of people that will have this problem. What the Mayo Clinic is proposing is something that's going to be very urgently needed. So I really perked up when I saw this, because I have felt the effects severely myself.
Yeah. Interesting.
I'm feeling a little nauseous right now, but it has nothing to do with VR.
It was Phil's birthday yesterday. So Phil celebrated last night.
Yes. Yeah. Phil enjoyed a few too many martinis last night. Yeah. Just like, wow. I got up this morning. It's like, oh man, this is going to take a day or two. So anyway, I was really interested in seeing that, because again, that is one of those pieces that I think can be limiting to VR. So hopefully this will help correct that. And it comes from our state. We're so proud.
Well, and when we were in Italy, we were in Rome, Alex and I, because his sister and mom were going shopping, and he and I had zero interest, so we went to this video game museum called Vigamus in Rome, and it was the first time that I'd used the Oculus Rift, and they had some games there, and there was not a lot of people in the museum, so we got to use it, and at one point, I started to stand up, and the young woman who was helping us, you know, grabbed my shoulders and pushed me back down into the chair, and she said, I don't, because I had headphones on, so she lifted up the headphones, she goes, we don't want you to stand up, too many people fall down. So I thought, oh, that's another interesting little twist on it that
I haven't actually done that.
Have you really?
Yeah.
So it's
bumped into furniture and all that. And the queasy, see, part of the queasiness is there are different variations of VR. There's Google Cardboard, which is something you hold in your hand and you hold up to your eyes, and you can sort of, without realizing it, sort of regulate the queasiness factor, because if you start feeling a little queasy, you can just pull the things down for a second or two and then put them back up. But the problem with more advanced VR setups like the Oculus is that these things are like jammed to your face with straps. What happens is you're sort of sensing the real world and you're sensing the virtual world, and the two are somewhat in conflict, and that's where the queasiness comes in.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Because it confuses your brain.
Exactly.
What do I pay attention to? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Julio.
A lot confuses my brain, so it's.
And this isn't on the show notes, but I during the Winter Carnival, I put a couple of 360 virtual reality cameras on the front of our branded Pioneer Press vehicle as it was moving through the parade. One of these was a little product that I was testing, a little ball-like camera. And another one was a full GoPro rig that Chuck Olson set up for me. And the results of those experiments were quite eye-opening. The videos, the virtual reality videos turned out very well.
Do you think there's any issue? We've seen what's happened with drones. Now that there's regulation, not only happening now, but also pending related to drones. And, with Google Street View, for example, they've had to create an algorithm to fuzz out, blur out anyone's faces and license plates and other identifying information. And I'm wondering if you think that 360 cameras, any kind of those kinds of views are going to be somehow limited, especially if you start putting them, in permanent places and all of that. Are you seeing anything like that, Julio?
Limited, how? I don't understand.
Well, just in terms of there's this, if you're in public, you don't have an expectation of privacy. So people could use any video they shoot, any photos they shoot, in any way they want. It's common courtesy to get releases, but then what about any commercial use of VR? You know, if there's people in the 360 video using it commercially, is that going to be any kind of an issue?
Well, if it's if the VR video is shot in a public place, it makes no difference whether it's 360 or not. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but
that's not a very good question. So,
but one. Yeah, but one thing to keep in mind is a lot of these questions are somewhat postponed because we're in the very early stages. You can't live stream 360 video yet. The horsepower just isn't there yet, and just shooting 360 video takes so much processing time, and so the content that is being created, the output of this stuff is still relatively limited. And so people right now are sort of focused on the technical issues and some of the more legal social issues, I think are yet to come. I think those conversations haven't really gotten started yet.
Well, this was supposed to be a big technology, years ago, and it never really made it out of the stage of being sort of a gimmick. Do you think that it's got legs this time?
Well, the difference now that didn't exist before is the hardware where there's a Chuck Olson has this little ball with slots with GoPro cameras pointing in different directions. So the key differentiator is sort of the multi-camera aspect, where the videos from the different cameras are later stitched together. And there's this Nokia camera that's even better, because it's all an integrated, it's this sort of ball-like thing, an integrated unit. But again, it has the cameras pointed in different directions, and that exponentially increases the quality. Yeah, it's just incredibly realistic compared to what existed before. Where you had to put it, a single camera on a tripod and then sort of rotate and record as you go, and that did not create the same kind of immersive experience.
Julio, you did a nice piece on PCs for people. We've talked about this on and off over the course of the last 6 to 8 months, I guess, but maybe the last year, about how that particular low income, that help for low income people getting access to the internet and access to computers was kind of threatened by a pullout from Sprint. And so, tell us what. So there's good news on that horizon, it looks like.
Yeah. Well, Sprint. There are these two national nonprofits that lease spectrum from Sprint so they can offer low cost internet access to schools, to nonprofits, and to the disadvantaged. And that low cost internet is then provided by local organizations such as PCs for People, which is based in St. Paul. It is itself a nonprofit. And PCs for People sells low-cost computers, and then they also offer this low-cost internet access. What happened with Sprint is that they're decommissioning their WiMAX network,
right.
And the WiMAX network is what was being used for this low-cost internet access. Everything needed to switch over to LTE. The problem was Sprint was playing hardball. They wanted to throttle. They basically wanted to clamp down and really throttle the service. Make it basically useless, because if you're using internet in your home, even though it's going over cellular, if you throttle it, it becomes useless. So your home broadband, needs to essentially be unlimited. So there were some very testy negotiations going on for a number of months, but that whole issue has been resolved between Sprint and the nonprofits. And the other thing that needed to happen was this very epic mass migration of customers from WiMAX over to LTE. And so there was a lot of frantic efforts going on for the last few months at PCs for People and some other places to migrate people over. And that process isn't concluded, but they've made a lot of headway. And so poor people in the Twin Cities who depended on this internet service and for a time were concerned that it would be taken away from them or it might go away. Those fears have been laid to rest, and everything is now resolved. Everything's hunky dory.
Well, this is pretty good stuff, and also I'm gonna put a link in the show notes to the Blandon Foundation's archive of March. Ann Tracy, I think everybody knows Ann, blogs and does a lot of, covers all the events and so forth for the Blandon Foundation, and they're all about strengthening rural Minnesota. And there's also things going on to really kickstart broadband in rural areas, especially healthcare facilities and so on. And so I'll put a link in the show notes for that too.
And Julio, I must say that I really respect you to have to put up with the asinine comments to some of your stories. I was looking
at, oh yeah, no through, kidding.
Oh my God, the commenters on this story are just, oh my God, where did these people come from?
On the PCs for People story?
Yes.
I as a matter of policy, I never read the comments on my stories, but
that's probably a good idea, because
but you piqued my interest, I'll have to go take a look.
We are talking some real assholes. So I just want you to know that. So I really admire you for putting it out there, brother. Jeez Louise. But anyway, also on speak kind of related to Sprint, You did another piece on the new was the regional president of Sprint here in our region. That's
They did a mass reorganization. Now they have sort of 18 little territories, each with its own president.
right.
And they've de-siloed themselves, so now that president is responsible within his domain. He's responsible for absolutely everything, including customer service and so forth. And so this guy, he was kind of a breath of fresh air because I expected this guy in a suit and tie to walk off the elevator. And this is a former army dude who was wearing a bomber jacket and a buzz cut, and he was a very interesting guy to meet. But his spiel was that in the past, Sprint in the Twin Cities had been very unreliable because they were undergoing some infrastructure updates that drastically degraded quality. The call dropping was a sort of an epidemic at that time. In fact, the Pioneer Press had at one point distributed Sprint phones to all of its employees, and they had to pull the plug on that. They had to give back all the phones and switch everybody over to AT&T
Oh,
because Sprint was
jeez.
useless. And I was left with that bad taste in my mouth. And this guy basically was apologizing for that to the many to customer many customers who have left Sprint, and sort of saying, come back in, the water's fine. And some of the testing that has been done by third parties around the country sort of bears that out. Sprint has improved, and I did some informal testing of my own, speed tests and so forth. And it seems to be working a lot better than it did before. So Sprint is, it's possibly something for customers to take another look at. I would have in the past, I would have told people to stay the heck away from Sprint, whatever you do. Now it's starting to see them again like a viable option again. So.
Yeah, I've stayed with Sprint since moving to the Twin Cities in 2004. I've been with Sprint the whole time. There have been some rough spots, but I don't think I've really ever experienced total disaster service.
My Pioneer Press Sprint phone was useless,
Really?
absolutely useless. I could not for the life of me use it at all.
Wow, that's interesting.
Where I
So.
was anyway, here in St. Paul, so.
Huh.
That's cool. So I think it's interesting to see that owning up to the past problems and the how did you turn it the turn it term it the mea culpa campaign. So
And the PR person that pitched me this story said, "Hey, I want you to talk to this executive." And I said, not really, because every time I talk to one of these executives, they just give me, corporate speak that's absolutely useless. And
right.
this guy's candor was refreshing, so I actually was able to write a story. So.
That's great. Hey,
Nice.
Jason's going to join us in just a couple of minutes, and there's one last story we've got to cover because it's about his startup. Julio, take it away.
I've been sort of in stealth mode covering Flareon for the last couple of years. After Jason left the up, you guys are familiar with the Uptake,
Oh, very, yeah. Yep.
Sure.
The journalistic government, the political journalism entity. He left that partly for health reasons, but also because he had this idea for a startup, and we were having coffee one day, and he was sort of sketching on an artist pad, making these little drawings of these smart lamps that he had in his head, that have particle photon devices in them. And he had this idea to create smart devices with lights that sort of tell you things like snow emergencies. If there's a snow emergency, it'll be red, and so forth. He just had this idea for devices that can tell you things, via LED lights. And since then, I've sort of been sort of following them along, and their concept has evolved. They're now talking about devices that you can strap on light poles with the blessings of civic entities like cities and counties. If imagine a snow emergency, and these little lights are on the poles, and you can very easily tell, red if on this side of the street the lights are red, you can't park there. If they're white on the other side of the street, you're fine. Very simple idea, but very compelling. Imagine the amount of towing that could be
Oh my
eliminated
God.
with
Yeah, yeah.
this very simple idea.
Yeah, I
And
single-handedly funded the city of Minneapolis towing when I lived in South Minneapolis in my 20s in winter. Yeah.
And so he's been, you know, gradually bringing on talent, and he's sort of having his big coming out now. My story was basically his sort of coming out clarion, and it was easily the most one of the most interesting stories in my entire journalism career. Partly because Jason is just he's a visionary. He's a very interesting, very cool guy, and he has his energy, his mental energy. He's just bursting with ideas. And the people that he has brought on, you know, Justin Grammons and Patrick Roan and a bunch of other people, they're all very, very sharp. And it's been fascinating and kind of an honor to see them in action.
So, and so Jason Barnett's going to join us right now. Jason, are you with us?
I am. I just take myself off mute.
There you go.
How you doing?
Well, yeah. You know, Julio was just talking about how interesting the story has been and all the great things that you've been doing with Clarion. Thanks very much for joining us on the podcast to talk a little bit about what you're up to.
In the... I've been blushing on mute for the last few minutes.
I love it. So, well, tell us a little bit about, you know, if you have a chance to take a look at Julio's story, it's going to be available, obviously, in the Sunday paper, but it's also available online and that sort of thing. Yep. But very interesting story. You know, kind of take us from the time from the uptake where I think you really sort of you shined there, and then take us from the uptake to Flareon and the people that you've associated yourself with.
Yeah, so you know, it goes my interest in technology and art have obviously gone way back, and the article actually does a really good job of covering that. You know, when I was in the uptake, you know, it was a nonprofit, and we did some pretty interesting technological work with live streaming, you know, cell phone video in like 2008, all over the country. And at the time, no one was really doing that. And it was really fun to explore these realms of technology in journalism. And but, you know, as you guys know, the journalism industry is pretty difficult, and continuing, you know, high profile technology effort in a nonprofit in an industry with very little cash is difficult. And so I had a lot of frustration, you know, banging my head against the wall, trying to raise money for this vision I had for that organization. As the years go on, my health problems just got worse and worse. You know, again, the article does a really good job kind of spelling that out. But, you know, I lived with chronic pain for years, and trying to run, you know, a nonprofit with that vision in that industry with chronic pain all the time was just above and beyond anything I could handle. And so I knew I had to, like, find an exit. At the same time, you know, I'm the type of guy who's always like thinking about things and trying to figure out different ways of going about things. And so I had an idea, and you know, that idea kind of just started taking root. When I was another one of those moments that kind of that isn't in the story, but kind of like sticks in my head about when this idea really came real to me, was I was taking my son to like a practice or something in the middle of the winter, and there happened to be a snowbird going on the time. And if you live with chronic pain, you also live with like your temper at the very edge of reality, right? And so I was driving around trying to find a place to park, and I didn't know the neighborhood where, you know, the rules very well. And, you know, and so I said a couple choice words with my son in the back seat, and he is like, "Dad, dude," you know, it's like, "What's wrong?" And I was just like, "God," you know, I was like, "I just can't figure out a place to park. I don't know where to, you know, run late." And he's like, "Well, what would you do to fix it?" And I was like, "See that light? I would have it turn red." He's like, "Well, can you do that?" And I was like, "Yeah, I can." And so that's kind of where like the whole idea that I've been thinking about of Internet of Things and you know, time my brain was more in the home product world, and that kind of like exploded my whole thought of the process of this entire network grid of smart devices you know, interconnected across the metropolitan area, telling all sorts of information way past snow emergencies. And so that, you know, and that, I don't remember what, when that was. I think that was like 2013 maybe, or yeah, somewhere in that realm where, and then I just started thinking, and that process of thinking helped me figure out a path, you know, and I knew I needed to move away from the uptake for a lot of reasons. I had to take care of my health, but that gave me something to think about. And over time I just started, you know, developing the idea further, recruiting a team. And here we are.
Well, so this is maybe because we have a lot of obviously technical listeners. So when I look at the FlareBot, which is the LED ring that goes around the light pole, for example, that would do that red if there's a snow emergency on one side and white if it's okay to park on the other. These are, well, Particle has Wi-Fi and cellular and all of that. How do these things talk to one another? I mean, if I'm in the city of St. Paul and I look at this and I go, this is an awesome idea. How would we manage it? How would I flip a switch that would turn the correct streets on red and all of that? I mean, how do they talk to each other and so on?
Yeah. So there's a number of ways to approach that problem. And, you know, right now with our testing, they're done with a little website we set up that I'd hit a button on the website and the lights change, right? So it's manual.
Yeah.
That's just the testing. What I want to do is to try to get a larger test up and running with a partnership with either a city or municipality or a business campus or, you know, a college campus or anyone really. And then we would set up like a control center, that the signals would be sent out from, a single location, and that could be automated. It could be manual. My idea right now is it would be radio signals, right? So the city has emergency services, radios, yep, stations and whatnot. And we can send a signal out via radio to the devices. And that's how they would be controlled. So like if the city of St. Paul declares a snow emergency, you know, as they're sending out their tweets about it and their emails about it, and they're sending out their automated phone calls about it, we use a very similar system where we send out light signals. And the entire grid would be mapped out to obey the rules. So like, say we have a system set up in Minneapolis and St. Paul who have two different rules. Well, that's totally cool because we would know exactly what street follows what rules, and we would know exactly where each device is and what cue it gets. And so we would be able to control that pretty easily from a hierarchical sort of perspective.
You know, and then one other quick question, sorry guys for dominating here, but so my wife and I were talking about Julio's article because we went read through it, and of course your son running out in the street at 3 is just, you know, like the horror story of every nightmare that you ever have when you have kids, right? And
yeah.
So we were talking about this and she said, you know, what other kinds of things could this do? And we started to talk about different things that we thought, well, geez, you know, what if you had, you know, every house had a light on the front of it, during a 911 call, it would blink or something, or there'd be, some other markets that, I forget what else she had said, but she was talking about all these different ideas of the kinds of things that could be, you know, warning signals when we do the house tour on Summit Avenue. You know, that the lights, there's a certain light on, that the house tour group would put on every house. And if the light is on, the house tour is still working. And if not, then you can't go in and so on. And, you know, just all of these different things that could be notifiers. And I guess the point is, how do you guys, I'm sure you've whiteboarded out, you know, a million different ideas. How are you going
about a million different ideas.
Yeah, how are you going about sort of doing a triage on that and saying, all right, here are, you know, five that we can focus on right now? Not, you don't have to say what they are, but.
Yeah. So you know, honestly, you know, the one that shows up in the article and we talk about a lot are snow emergencies, and there's a very real reason that we're using that example. A similar example would be street sweeping, right? And there's a couple of reasons that those are ones. One, they're nuisance problems, right?
Yep.
They're not life and death situations. You know, so there's like when I've been talking to our lawyers, there's lots of liability concerns down the road with sending out wrong signals and whatnot. So we're walking into the functionality with our eyes wide open and trying to you know, take a couple low bar examples. And so, like street sweeping is one that also is nice because you want to be able to people to get off your street so they can sweep it.
Yeah.
And so when we're brainstorming ideas, you know, we're thinking of one ease, right? The most simple, like you know, the MPV, the minimal viable product kind of idea. What is the functionality that I could easily access? And snow emergencies is one, and so that's why we're focusing it. But some that excite me that fit in our public safety like goal is like when first responders come to a scene, right? Say it's either police or an ambulance at night. Well, as the vehicles are driving up, they could be cueing the lights to get brighter, and so you know when an ambulance shows up in a house at 2 a.m, all the street lights around that house get bright,
huh.
You know, like a whole lot brighter than normal. So it's really not easy to see. That would help, you know, it'd help the police. It would help things like, you know, capturing video at night for different types of situations. There's lots of really interesting things that can happen just to help people at night with these lights. I just think that one functionality of having the lights get brighter could help all sorts of people. Or say you're a jogger and you like to run at night, but, you know, you don't sometimes because you don't feel safe. Well, you could like subscribe to the system, and as you're running down the street, you know, the lights slowly dim, you know, brighten up as you're running by, and then they go back to normal as you know, you pass. And there's a billion different ways and different functionalities that we could do.
Yeah.
But one also really interesting thing is I happened to be able to go to New Zealand a few years ago, and I was, my wife has friends there. Her family worked there for a few years. So I'm talking to these people we were staying with and visiting, and I had this idea in my head, and what they said that what they would love it for are tsunami warnings.
Oh, yeah.
And that which applies to 90% of the population of the planet who lives on coastal areas, right? So tsunami warnings in New Zealand, they have them all the time. And normally they don't cause any damage or anything, but they still have to move, right? They still have to get off the shore. And what they said is what they cannot predict or they cannot convey to people very easily is how far inland do they go, right? And so like they know, their scientists kind of have a good idea of how far, you know, the water will come depending on the tsunami warning, but they have no way of conveying that. But if you have a grid along the coastal area with these lights, you know, you could direct traffic to once you get to the right elevation, then you're in all clear. So you just turn it on and people drive until it's green, you know, and they go. And so you'll be able to like, you know, let people move from danger areas to safe areas.
You know what?
To me, that fascinated me.
Well, you know what, Jason, I'm sorry to interrupt, but, The thing that really tugged at my heartstrings most was when there was video of the tsunami in Thailand and in this resort area. And there are, you see these people and they're like, hey, the sea's going out, and they're walking out there.
Yeah.
And I just thought, because they're clueless. I mean, they have no idea, right? I mean, they think it's
right.
Cool.
And why would they?
And why would they? But if there was an international agreed upon method where there would be lights or sirens or you know, something along the shoreline, everyone would know instantly what it was.
and they know what to do. So like, that's one reason why, like on even the prototype we have now, on the street poles, why they're in a ring. And the ring is not only because it can strap around the light pole. The ring means is a way that we want to be able to test directional information. So say there is an evacuation route and you have these rings on poles. Well, if you look at, if you're standing in the middle of the street and you look one way and all the lights are red for what you're looking, and you turn around and all the lights are green, which way are you going to go?
Right.
Right? The red, and towards the red? Is that the wrong answer?
That's the wrong answer, Phil.
That's the wrong answer.
Damn.
So, yeah, you're going to die.
It's the Darwin. Phil won the Darwin Award today.
That's right. That's exactly that's right. Right. It's called, you know, it's kind of, you know, thinning the herd. That's
right.
See, one question that I have is, since you've got a computer running on each of these boxes on the pole, do you have any vision for connecting more information? So a passerby might get more information with a Bluetooth beacon, as an example, on their smartphone.
Yes. So like, we've brainstormed all of these different ways. This thing can be really crazy robust and do all of these insane stuff. But yeah, I mean, one of the things that fascinates me is just like all the Bluetooth Connect stuff. And like, we plan on having mobile apps because, you know, when, you know, people may not know what right away what some of these lights mean. Well, we want to have a mobile app associated with it. So the additional information would be beamed to you depending on exactly where you are along the grid. And so, you know, if the light turns red, you would be able to get a notification on your phone too that say, oh, well, this red means this. And, you know, or if there's like unusual colors or something, you know, then there'd be a mobile app that would send additional information. And what I've found in, you know, the years of work in media is you got to have different levels of information to be communicated. You know, pictures are really useful in articles, right? And the reason why pictures are useful in articles is because they can tell the story much faster and bring people into the article, you know, before they even want to read it, right? And the same with these lights. Like, the lights will get your attention, and they'll go, okay, well, something's going on because that's on. What does that mean? And well, then you get the additional context through the mobile app that would be able to give information. And the points where I see that coming really useful are like for amber alerts, right? And so like, if there's an amber alert, like say all the lights turn amber, right? And you're like, well, what the hell does that mean? And well, you'd be able to get all the information from the amber alert on your phone with associated pictures or car descriptions or whatever else that are useful for that specific event. And you'd be able to get that on your phone immediately. And so, which I think would help Amber Alert a lot because, you know, when you get those text messages, when you're in cities that have the Amber Alert functionality, you know, there's an Amber Alert, but you really don't know anything else.
Right.
And to me, that's kind of useless, right? But like, great, you're stressing me out, making me feel bad about this kid, but I cannot help. Like, there's no way that I would be able to recognize anything. Great, there's a car description, you know. But if there is like pictures or, you know, of the actual kid or of like example car, like if it's a blue sedan, you know, have a picture of a blue sedan, you know, I don't know. But there's ways to like give additional information through mobile apps.
Well, and that, you know,
yeah.
Well, and the reason that that's so good is that Eden Prairie participates in that system for alerts of all kinds, and they test it every quarter. And so all the phones that we have signed up for that, and so my mobile, my Google Voice, my home phone, I get an SMS, blah, blah, blah. And my wife is almost always traveling, and sometimes she's overseas when these alerts come in. And so she's getting a call, and then if you don't answer it, then they'll call again. And if you don't answer it, they'll call again. And then if you answer it and hang up after, you know, 10 seconds, they'll call again. And then they're SMSing. And she just finally said, take me off. And so I took her off. Well, and the same thing. And so people end up, so now you can't alert them at all because they just said, hey, I can't deal with these tests.
Yeah. So and honestly, I think that's one of the serious problems with a lot of these notifications that are going out through via cell phone is that we're and we've talked about this internally too, is the problem of over notification.
Yeah.
And that's one reason why, like, you know, I'm much less interested in developing mobile apps to try to solve a problem, you know, when mobile apps by themselves to solve problems, because there's too many mobile apps and right. there's too many notifications coming out, you know, on that one device that's sitting in your pocket. It's already, it's like it's an insane email inbox. Right. And you know, so the user experience for some of these really important things, they need to be, you know, simple and informative, but they can't be constant and nagging, or that's exactly what's going to happen, is you're going to unsubscribe. And the last thing you want is to unsubscribe when something real happens, right?
Yeah.
And these systems are being set up to save people's lives and help people, you know, navigate safely. And if people are turning them off because they're annoying, well, then they got, you know, those people building the product have a serious problem.
Yep.
Well, I tell you, it's the beginning of a really great opportunities, and I'm happy to see Flarion and Jason, you get involved in it, and congratulations. We'll keep an eye on what happens next. Will we see you at IoT Fuse?
You know, I didn't get a ticket. They sold out so fast.
I bet you we know people.
Well, I'm one of the co-organizers, so send me an email.
Okay.
All right.
There you go.
So I saw it come through, and I was like, yeah, I need to do that. And then,
plus your CTO. I know your CTO, so he's one of the co-organizers,
right,
too.
Exactly.
And we should say briefly a little bit about the team that you have assembled. You know, Justin Grammans, who we've had on the show many times. We worked with him on so many different things. And Christina Dervid. How does she pronounce her last name? I never really know. Is it Dervid or Dervid?
And I now stumble on it. I think it's Durvaj.
Oh, there you go.
Yep, and I saw it at the first IoT
cool
Fuse.
Last name. I just can't.
Yeah, I saw it at the first IoT Fuse and took some video of her tweet skirt. That was pretty cool.
She's amazing. It's fun to work with her too. She's just fun and quirky and all that. It's really good. But yeah, so like the team, you know, the team has been really awesome, and they all have different strengths. And that's what you need in a team, is, you know, not only do I believe in a diverse team of what these people are, and that's really important to me, but they're also very different in skill sets, and you know, that's what you need when you're recruiting, is you need a diverse set of skill sets, especially skill sets that help my weaknesses, right? And you always recruit to your weaknesses. And this team does a really good job of that.
Well, and you got Patrick Rohn as a communications guy, and his, you know, he really understands. He gets to the essence of stuff and the meaning.
He really does.
Behind tech.
So. Yeah, no, and that's you know, I've known Patrick for years, and when I was, you know, trying to pull a team together, you know, Patrick was one of my first go-tos, because he just. You know, him and I see eye to eye on a lot of the large vision of stuff, and like the deep thought stuff, and you know, it's really nice to have someone on your team that you know, if you're confused about a long term strategy or vision, you know, you can just say, hey, Patrick, what do you think about this? Yeah. And he'll then talk for 15 minutes about a whole range of things, and you're like, great, good, this is either confirming or bringing up something that I had not thought of. And that's, you know, it's really nice to have that, you know, that kind of thought.
Well, and it would be nice if he could maybe get a journalist to write a good story about you. Oh, no, never mind. There's one right here.
Well, listen.
Yeah, it's been really fun working with Julio. It's, you know, I've also known Julio forever, but, you know, he's been very patient with following the story, and I was, you know, I just can't tell you the response I've gotten from it so far.
Great.
I got an email from an official source that I can't say yet, in government, even before I knew it went online. And like, I hadn't seen Julio's email that it was up online. And I got an email from, some interesting people saying, really love your idea. Like, how do you know about it?
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Well, big things ahead for you, Jason. Lots of big things ahead. So thanks very much for sharing a little bit of, you know, so now we can all look back and say, hey, we knew him when. So congratulations and keep plugging away, man.
Well, thank you guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being on.
Yep.
Take care.
Great, you guys. Thanks.
Okay.
We probably should just before we, you know, we're probably running a little long, but let's talk about our cool things of the week, guys. Did you guys take some time to put together a cool thing of the week?
Yeah, but we at least have to just mention the 9.7 inch iPad Pro because I bought one.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. What? Yeah. Yeah. I bought the 256 gig wireless and pardon me.
Did you get the pencil?
I did get the pencil. I did not buy the Apple Smart Keyboard because I had read some things that were not terribly flattering. And there's a different one that, Julio, you might know about called the Bridge.
Yeah, it's not out yet, though, right?
Oh, it's not? Oh, okay.
No.
Okay. Well, I've read some things about that, or a couple of reviews. And
I think the Bridge, the one they're designing is for the larger iPad Pro, though.
No, they do have a 9.7.
Oh, they
well.
Do. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But I didn't know. I didn't know if it was shipping. But everybody was that's written something about it has said it's great. But it is. You know what the big thing is. This is going to sound funny, but you've always been able to use a stylus to take notes in these various note taking apps and drawing apps and that kind of stuff. But you always had to futz around, you know, moving something up so that you could control for your wrist touching the iPad. With the Apple Pencil, all that's gone. I mean, literally, I looked at this and went, oh my gosh, I can actually handwrite notes now and use this thing in the way I always wanted to use it. And so I took it to my first meeting, and it works perfectly. And so now I have all my notes digital. I will have all my notes digitally. So,
does it do OCR like the Surface Pro does?
It does. It does.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, it depends on which app you use, but yes. So that's cool. All right, let's talk cool things of the week. Who wants to go first? Nobody? Tim, you go first.
So I found this a couple of weeks ago. It's a Kickstarter, and it's an interesting kit from Italy, which is called the Domotics Kit. And it's basically a smart home play. That's modular, that uses Arduino and Raspberry Pis, and you can, you know, start small and add to it, or you can buy a larger set that, you know, that can automate your entire house to do all of the smart house stuff, controlling your lights and, you know, being able to find out what the temperature is and controlling access to your house. When your kid gets home, you get a little SMS that says your kid got home at whatever time it was. So, interesting idea. It looks like it's around 100 euros or so. They've just started their Kickstarter, so it's, you know, it's very early, and they're looking for, I think it's 40,000 euros, something like that. But yet another, you know, good idea out there, and I liked it because it combined a lot of the off-the-shelf you know, controllers and little microcomputers. Huh. I thought it tied in with our guest as well.
Well, and I looked at the Kickstarter thing, and there's some links on here to some things that I did not know about. So probably all the developers do, but the Cosmo server. So there's a server software that you can incorporate into this Domotics platform and others. And it has a scheduler. It has an API. It has a scheduler. You can create a house plan. It allows monitoring. And then there's this thing called the Cosmo Cloud, which I'm sure you pay a developer fee for. So your data, your client's data can go up there and back. But very interesting stuff. That's cool. Yeah. That's a cool kit. That is cool. Okay.
And what they're pitching it is that it's kind of like a quasi-makery kind of a thing. So you can, you know, work with your kids on electronics and have this great benefit. So it's a little bit different than a, you know, prepackaged thing like a SmartThings is, where it's more of a consumer product. This is more of a maker / learning platform. It reminded me of HeathKits, actually.
Ooh, HeathKits.
I remember those.
for those back in the day.
Back in the day. Cool.
Phil.
Yes. Right. Well, I'm just kind of curious, Steve, are you going to, you know, I had some technical difficulty there, so I missed. Did you segue nicely from your 9.7 inch iPad Pro, or are you going to do another cool thing as well?
No, well, I am going to do a cool thing. That wasn't my cool thing.
Oh, it wasn't your cool thing.
No, it would have been, but then we were going to cover the story, so I thought, nah, I'll do another one that I think is cool.
All right. Okay, so, very nice.
All right.
Anyway, today, you know, my cool thing is the unveiling of the $35,000 Model 3 Tesla.
Yeah.
Which I actually have some friends that have actually put down a grand.
Yep.
To reserve one.
And they're over 200,000 orders now.
And it's just like, okay, well, there you go. Working capital for the fine folks at Elon at Musk.
Well, I bought 100 shares of Tesla a while back, so I've got to disclose that, right? No.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
But I thought actually it was gonna go up. A good looking ride. I'm having a hard time getting past the no vent on the front of the car, which is, you know, the no grill. But other than that, it's interesting to see how this is going to roll out in 2017. So,
well, the really weird thing is that behind the steering wheel, there's nothing.
Yes,
there's nothing. It's just that little computer-like panel on in the middle.
Yep, that's it.
So that's I'm having a little trouble getting past the fact that you have to like look over to see how fast you're driving. So it's a little weird.
You know, it could change. You never know.
Yeah, it probably. Yeah, there's a lot of analysts that are saying this is sort of make or break for Tesla, if they can really pull this off or not.
Well, so if they can scale, yeah.
Yeah, there's questions whether or not they can actually do this, will it come out next year or it will be later, and will the price really be 35 grand or will it be somewhat higher than that? So
it starts at 35 grand. So maybe for 36 grand, you have something to look at on the dashboard, Julio. You never know.
But the key element is it's compatible with the supercharger station. So this, like any other Tesla, can be driven cross country.
Right.
Well, and just FYI, guys, for a week from tomorrow, I'm working on a big Tesla story.
Oh, very nice.
Sweet.
That's a tease.
I'm talking to as many local people who have slapped down $1,000 for the Tesla as I can. And Phil, I'd love to talk to your friends who have done that.
All right, sure. Yeah, I'll let them know. But yeah, I have a hard time with that. I mean, I love I would love to have a Tesla. I admire Elon Musk and the company. I think the cars that they've built are wonderful looking cars. As much as a fan as I am, I'm sorry, I refuse to buy a pig in a poke. I mean, I'm not gonna give my $1,000 to, you know, and ultimately be disappointed with it. So it's you never buy the first year of a car, a model car. Never buy the first model.
What does pig in a poke mean? I don't understand.
Oh, just buying something without seeing it. So.
Oh, got it.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. But anyway, that's one of those things that some people want to put their money out there doing that. But I think it's a cool looking ride. Steve, what's your other cool thing?
Well, my other cool thing is something called Blog Booker. So one of the things that I've been thinking about is, you know, I've been blogging since December of 2004, and I've got thousands of posts, and there's no really efficient way to archive my blog. And so I started poking around Wednesday night, just, you know, had my laptop out, and I was playing and looking around, and I found this thing called Blog Booker, which allows you to make a PDF out of your blog. And so you put your URL in there, and then it produces it, and it's got layout issues. But in beta, they give you the PDF, and then you can also download Word doc versions by year. And and so if you want to go in and clean it all up, you can. And then if you want to donate, which I did, I donated $25, they send you a high res or a version with high res images in it.
Cool.
Because otherwise they compress the heck out of them. The point though is I've got it. I've got my entire blog done, and it puts a table of contents in there if you check that off and so on. So it was really awesome.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right.
Mr. Ojeda Zapata, do you have a cool thing?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring your. I have one of the new iPads on loan from Apple. I really, really liking it. I like the smart keyboard, but I just want to bring your attention to a couple of accessories that I think are just phenomenal. I don't like an iPad keyboard that is attached, that is permanently attached to the iPad. I like the flexibility of just using the iPad as an iPad when I want to, and then adding in the keyboard when it's needed.
Yep.
And otherwise, you know, just setting the keyboard aside. And the Zags Messenger Universal is this little folio-like thing that when you unfold it, there's a keyboard, and then the lid sort of folds into a stand. Full-size keyboard, the stand is will accommodate any device. It doesn't matter what device you have. I've been using it with the big iPad Pro, with the little iPad Pro, even with my smartphone. Fantastic keyboard that I just keep in my backpack, and when I want to do some hardcore work, I pull that sucker out, put the whatever device I'm using in the stand, and do some really hardcore work.
What's the name of it again?
Messenger Universal from Zag.
Oh, okay.
And then when I just want to sit, I want to veg out on the couch watching a movie with just my iPad, I just forget the keyboard even exists. I just put it back in my backpack and just use the iPad as an iPad. And that, for me, that hits my sweet spot. I mean, it's not for everybody, but that's what I want. And the smart keyboard, the problem with the smart keyboard with the smaller iPad Pro, a little scrunched, and I really don't like that. I need a full, you know, I need full size keys, you know, properly spaced out. And this is absolutely perfect, absolutely perfect. Huh.
And this I was just going to ask you a question about that. So, you know, if you have, for example, the Apple case on your iPad, you can just still prop it up there, right?
Yeah, like with the big iPad Pro, I have the full Apple, the rubbery case that has the backing and the lid.
Uh-huh.
And so I open the lid, flip it around to the back, and then just jam that thing in the sand. It fits perfectly.
Nice.
Then with the little iPad, I can even do. I have the smart keyboard on there all the time, but then I can just flip it around to the back and then just put it in the Zag. It's perfect. Yeah. The other accessory I just want to quickly bring your attention is the new Lightning to USB 3 camera adapter. This is a little Lightning thing that you plug into your iPad, and on the other end there's a USB port. A couple of really important things to keep in mind: it's not just a camera adapter. It's also a fantastic way to plug in a high quality mic. You can do hypothetically do some high quality podcasting on there, and if you have one of those Apple USB to Ethernet adapters, you can actually do Ethernet with your iPad, which is crazy.
You know, I saw that, and it actually works.
Wow. It actually works.
You've tried that?
Yeah.
Huh. Very nice.
And you don't have any. There's no readouts or no like control. Options on your iPad. There's nothing. The iPad has no settings or, let's say, Ethernet anywhere, but it just, behind the scenes, it just works. It's really
very
amazing.
Cool.
So.
Very, very,
very
cool.
What do we got coming up for events, guys?
Well, we have a couple new ones on here. I bet you, Tim, you put this on here, Twin Cities Code Camp.
Bunch of new ones, yeah. Code Camp coming up on the 16th of April.
Yep.
At the U of M.
Yep, and I also put GlitchCon, which is sort of a maker meets gamer sort of unconference, and that will be at the McNamara Alumni Center on the 29th and 30th of the month.
Very cool.
And then Maker Fair.
This one I'm really looking forward to, yeah.
Yeah, the 14th of May, we'll be at the fairgrounds again.
Yep,
so.
Yep.
Yep, those are the new ones, and all the other ones, you know, that we've talked about before are in there.
Great. Great, like great.
If you want to plug that again, Steve?
IoT Fuse, April 22nd. And
be
it's
part of the wait list.
Well, it's, yeah, we're way, we actually, we met with them and we're way over already. So, but you know what? I mean, you'll be have pretty high attrition when it's a free event.
Right.
But get on the wait list. It's my recommendation.
There you go.
All right.
All right. So, and then next week is the close one is the AlterConf. I'll be at that. That starts at 11 in the morning, so it's kind of a late start thing. So we'll be able to do the podcast and talk about it.
Sweet. All right.
So lots of stuff to talk about next week on
the Minivate Gang Podcast. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Julio.
Yeah, no problem. Take it easy.
See you. Bye.